you from our congregation in the Imperial Gymnasium. I want to also thank the college leader, Mr. Jacot, for the lovely choral arrangement that is usually presented to us when we're asked to speak here. I would like to give you a few asides before I come to the subject for today. We hope that you will remember the needs of our Karen brethren who are on the Burmese-Thai border. I have on occasion addressed this matter. You see, we're in a world in which not an insignificant number of God's people are in fact refugees for various reasons before they perhaps become converted, sometimes after they become converted. We have no insignificant number of people in our congregations in this country where English is not the primary language, and I won't identify that any further, who are people who were, in fact, not legal residents of this country before they were converted. That happens because of the nature of the crises in neighboring countries. Well, it just also happens that under circumstances, some of our brethren in parts of Asia who already were brethren had to cross into Thailand if they didn't want to fall into the hands of the military to the west. That's Burma. And in so doing, in a sense, they are guests and under supervision of certain Thais. But it puts them in an awkward position. We are of the general impression at this point that the local administrators are gracious enough to grant at least some of the brethren the opportunity to visit our brethren from various countries who will be keeping the Feast of Tabernacles in Chiang Mai in Thailand. Now, this could present a little problem. In the first place, most of the brethren going to Thailand come from what we call the first world. But these other brethren do not. They not only don't come from the first world, they don't come from the second. They were cast out of the third. And so you can understand some of their potential problems. I trust that everyone who may be leaving from here, so I'm saying this in a sense in advance, will realize that these brethren do know several languages, but they may not understand how we spend money. And you should realize, of course, that when we spend our money, we do it judiciously and wisely, but our income for a year, in many cases in those parts of the world, would be a life time income, or what you would have, you see, as the festival top, would represent the income for many years, the full income for many years of some of these people. Now, they don't live in poverty in the sense that fruits fall off the trees, herbs grow out of the ground, and they don't have to pay with our currency. But nevertheless, it is important that we pay for their general welfare and safety, and that we also realize that we must be discreet and understanding and helpful in how we befriend our brethren who have never been outside before a country that was never recognized as a country, because these people grew up in a republic of Khasi Lay that you will not find on a map. It represents an area that Burma claims that it had no full control over since the Burmese state was founded in 1948. It also represents an area not recognized by the United Nations. And these people have had to live by their wits. The last man who was converted among them be shot because the Republic of Quatulay could not afford this attrition to the Church of God. So today, in a sense, the doors are closed, and our brethren have all had to leave that area and become refugees in a country which does not accept refugees from this area legally. They simply have had to go there, and we can be very grateful that the local governor of Tak province or another province has been gracious enough to accept them. My wife and I are planning to go to Europe. This is an assignment we appreciate. My wife has never been to Czechoslovakia before, although some of her relatives came from the area. I have been there in 1966, which is 21 years ago. That is, I was there longer ago than most freshmen were born. It's hard to realize, of course, how time goes by, and that seems very recent to me. But for some of those who are freshmen or sophomores or perhaps even juniors in college, beginning the junior year, you'll soon be 22, most of you, if you aren't already, it's like an entire lifetime. I would like to explain just a little bit about a country like that. In Czechoslovakia, when you wanted to say things that did not get to Russian ears, you had to be very careful and whisper. And you had to be sure you were out of distance of anybody else, and you had to be sure whosoever ears were hearing you understood what your intent was and understood your attitude. Now, the Hungarians, who are their neighbors, didn't have this problem. I was in both countries in 1966. There, the Hungarians could be no more than 10 feet from the Russians, and they would talk in Hungarian about the Russians, and the Russians couldn't understand them. Now, they talked reasonably respectfully, but they nevertheless talked and felt confident. But the Czechs speak a language so related to the Russian that any Russian hearing Czech spoken would think it's some Russian peasant who is speaking it. So that's the way they look upon the language. It's a low, low Slavic language. The Czechs do not see it that way, but you know what I mean. There are certain standards, and the Russians have the standards of literature that simply were not characteristic of the Slavic language that the Czechs came to use. But it put them in a very awkward situation, whereas the Hungarians were far more casual in discussing their relationship with their Soviet brothers. And that explains, I think, a significant part of the problem, that wherever Slavic was spoken, people had to be far more discreet. And the Hungarians, of course, spoke a language far more difficult for most people to grasp. Even the Romanians speak at least a Latin language as a whole. And therefore, if a Russian had learned French, it might not be difficult to pick up even some Romanian, because Romanian is a Latin language. Anyway, we will try to convey our best wishes to you, to our brethren who will be meeting in Brno, or Brünn, as they would commonly call it there, behind the Iron Curtain, some possibly from Poland, some from East Germany, I think some from Yugoslavia, and, of course, brethren from elsewhere in Europe and those transferring from North America. We will be leaving this evening, but not for the reason that you may imagine. I just thought you should know, you've heard about the problem of young soldiers who die of cancer or leukemia or things of that nature who were in Vietnam, presumably because of Agent Orange or other chemicals that were used as defoliants. Well, we had a call just, this is Thursday, it was Tuesday night, that my wife's brother's son, who was in the war, they're not members of God's church, had died of cancer that clearly could be linked to his having to lay down airstrips on immediately defoliated areas during the Vietnam War. or as one soldier who was in the hospital where this young man of 40 went, one soldier immediately asked him the question, were you in Vietnam? And the answer, of course, was yes, yes. He had cancer that appeared first on the foot and then in the lung. The one cancer was solvable by good, I would say, diet and understanding of those things nutritionally that we might know, but there was no way to resolve the other problem. And I think we have to realize, of course, the government knows it now, but they are not in a position to really say it is scientifically proved any more than the tobacco industry is willing to say certain things are scientifically proved that the Surgeon General knows to be quite true. It's simply an attitude, but after all, when you are in the military, you are serving the government, and you serve being willing to give up your life, and sometimes you gave it up on the battlefield, and sometimes you simply were chemically poisoned and give it up later. But that's the situation. So we will be going to the funeral tomorrow in the Midwest, and we'll be happy to visit. Interestingly, one of the Meredith family is here. We'll be visiting with the church in Joplin on the Sabbath. And I appreciate that Mr. Salyer suggested that my wife and I be able to be there. For what it's worth to him, if he had sent us between here and Joplin with 30 days advance notice, it would have cost more to send us than it actually is going to cost, because we're only going to fly to Kansas City, which is much cheaper, and we will take the responsibility of the ground route. So in that sense, happily, I'm glad to say that although there were no more than 2 days' notice, that in fact it would be cheaper by us taking the ground route and being responsible for that, cheaper to church administration than if we had actually been assigned all the way to Joplin by air with 30 days advance. Now, if that is ridiculous, of course it is. But this is in fact what happens, that you can't tell what the cost of routes are going to be. To Kansas City, it's inexpensive. To get there, from there to Joplin is much more expensive. And so happily, since we can't afford the time to get there, we will simply take ground transportation. But I think it is important that you realize that we get letters from time to time, and I read them, and I know of people who work with soldiers who have suffered the consequences of these poisons. And we don't realize or even begin to understand how serious some of these problems are in this country. And, of course, wherever such chemicals are used in warfare. I would like to take a moment of time and give a few observations that Mr. Hagvold prompted. Of course, he's gone much further than I have in the areas in which he is professionally gifted and is serving our student body as a whole. I would draw to your attention a few things you might like to take note of. When the original reference to the darkness that occurred, that Mr. Hagvold referred to, when that original word appeared in the Greek as Luke wrote it, he used a word that we would translate as eclipse. Years later, Greek being a living language, the Bible being meant to be understood and not to be misunderstood in the original language in which it was written, the Greek language was used in such a way that it became a decision of the leaders in the Greek world to substitute the word that is translated darkness rather than eclipse. See, what has happened is that the original word that came to be associated with a natural eclipse meant a darkening at a time when not everybody understood the phenomenon that occurs in the heavens between the earth, the moon, and the sun. Now, in this connection, what that phenomenon came to be understood, the word eclipse came to be an astronomical term and no longer was appropriate for the word darkness in general, which could occur apart from an eclipse, the technical eclipse. Nevertheless, I would draw to your attention that even though at a later time another word, darkness, was substituted to make clear the original meaning of a word that took on a special meaning later, that when the Greeks finally came to print the Bible, to give us that form of the Greek language in which the Bible originally came to be written and handed down, they did adopt the original word that technically today means eclipse. But I would have you know that in earliest days, that had reference not merely to the phenomenon in the heavens that would occur, the eclipse of the sun at mid-month, but to any unusual, in that sense, darkness, whether or not caused by such a relationship as may occur at the full moon. You may ask, of course, why Mr. Haigbold cited the fact that this is the beginning of the year 5748. I think it is important on occasion that we rehearse the fact, since this is the Feast of Trumpets, that is, this is also Rosh Hashanah, or the head of the year. Now, there are two kinds of years. There is the religious or sacred year, which begins in the spring with the first of Nisan, or the month of Aviv. Then there is the month that begins now, the month of Tishri, as we call it. Anciently, it had another name. In fact, the Jewish calendar that determines the holy days, the calendar determines the holy days, the numbering of the days, of course, is given to the in the Bible. But which day of the month is actually determined by the calendar, because that is determined by when a new moon occurs. Now, the calendar is calculated today and has been throughout its history from the beginning based on this month being the first month. Even when Nisan is called the first month and this is called the seventh month, the determination of when a year begins is not based on Nisan calculating the new moon of that month, but it's based on calculating the new moon of this month. That has never changed. You see, it really isn't the Jews' calendar. It really isn't the Hebrew calendar. If the Jews descend from Judah, and if Hebrew people descend from Heber, but the calendar goes back so that this is year 5748, we are back there in the days of Adam and Seth and Enoch. So the calendar that we have today is, in a sense, only preserved among Hebrew people, preserved by the Jewish nation. This is very important to realize. They were the recipient. Moses is simply saying in his day, in God's direction in Exodus 12, that instead of beginning in the autumn, we will renumber the months now so that the spring month begins the year. And the numbering henceforth will be based on that. Nevertheless, the calculation to determine the calendar today, as every year since Moses, whenever it had to be calculated, was based on determining the new moon of this month or determining the first day of the seventh month, which we would, from Moses' day till now, call Rosh Hashanah, the head of the year. The very name in the Hebrew of this day, of course, shows that there were always two ways of looking at the year. But let me say a little something more. The Jews at a later time, probably in the later first century of the present era, meaning somewhere before 100 AD, had already adopted the general idea that the calendar must have begun the time of creation week, or they associated creation week described in Genesis 1 and in Genesis 2 with the beginning of the calendar, and hence the Jews assigned the period of 3761 to 3760, that is their first year, as ending with the story of creation week. Now that simply isn't true. The date for the Hebrew calendar and the numbering, as far as I'm concerned, is legitimate. But that's not when creation week occurs. In order to link that with the Bible, the Jews were faced with a very, very traumatic problem. How were they going to fit the Bible history into such a date? The end result was that they simply stripped away scores of years from the Persian period in order to bring creation week down to this point in time. Instead of where, and talking about the week of recreation, not the beginning, instead of where it should be. That means, in a sense, that Jewish scholars today know that the Persian period is exactly as long as we know it to be. Persia overthrew Babylon in the beginning of autumn in 539 BC, and Cyrus's first year as emperor began with the spring of 538 BC, and Alexander, over a period of approximately 3 years, between 333 and 330 BC, overthrew Emperor Darius, the last Persian king. So the Persian Empire, in fact, existed for more than 200 years. And by removing the bulk of that material in time and simply saying it didn't exist, they were able to link creation week in their reasoning with the beginning of the calendar. Now, in the calendar that we publish, we don't mention this date and we don't mention the beginning because we do not feel that this is an issue that needs to be addressed to co-workers and others. But it is important that you do understand that there's nothing wrong with the Jewish numbering of the year. There's nothing wrong with the idea that, in fact, the specific new moon that came to be the basis of all later calculations occurred in the year 3760 B.C. The conjunction occurred on the sixth day of the week at the beginning of that seventh month. And it was the 13th hour of the day reckoning from 6 p.m. the previous night, or the 8th hour of the day reckoning from midnight. Exactly. And that's what is used today. What Mr. Hagwell was telling you is that there is a calculation that is known to the Jews, to the Arabs, and now to anyone in the educated world, that goes back for many centuries, in fact, nearly two millennia, in public literature, that says it also that that same figure was known as early as 3760 B.C., at the end of this year, 3761 to 3760, because the Jews count year one as the one that ended with this new moon, which is the one that actually was originally used in 3760. And so the Jews have known this, and the remarkable thing is that indeed we can determine the nature of the calendar well in advance, and we can go back in history and unravel the story. If you simply use the fixed calendar as we know it, with whatever historic adjustment occurred after Jesus' time, specifically in AD 256, I used to think it was earlier, but I think that is now demonstrable in Jewish and Christian tradition, where there was a postponement of the 13th month in the cycle. Apart from that, we can determine, for example, that the Passover, the 14th day of the first month, occurred on a Saturday, the seventh day of the week. In other words, Friday night, Saturday, in the year that Joshua crossed the Jordan, which is required by the book of Joshua. We can determine that in AD 31, the proper year for the crucifixion, that indeed the Passover was a Wednesday by the Hebrew calendar. That, for that matter, is also determined by the Babylonian calendar for the same year, which essentially was the same calendar but regulated by the Babylonians. So indeed it is remarkable that we can go back so that when this day is perceived to be the first day of the seventh month, it is a very significant fact. because in reality it was calculated and determined in advance as early as 3760 B.C. That's what it means. That you can start there with the given information and come up with this date. Now, necessarily, a month is either 29 or 30 days, but the length of a moon from essentially conjunction to conjunction is 29 days and 12 hours and 44 minutes and 3 1/3 seconds. So that, you don't have to put that down. We're not asking you to be in charge of the calendar. But the point being, it is not 29 or 30. It is something in between. And for that very reason, the conjunction will vary somewhat just because the length of a month is either less or more than the actual average length of a month. The actual average length of a month, which is a fraction over 29 and a half days. And in a similar fashion, of course, the Feast of Trumpets begins with, let's say, our brethren in Tonga, much earlier. If the conjunction, in a sense, was a little earlier than we may be celebrating it, you have to realize the day is coming to us late. And when it gets to Samoa and Hawaii and parts of Alaska, it's going to be very late. But the day began long ago, by watch, for our brethren in New Zealand and Tonga, in Yap and Guam, Australia, Manila, the Philippines, you see, as you go west. So, in that sense, we live on a round earth with a few of those problems. And God, of course, intends that there should be basic unity. As we are one family, so also we are, in that sense, one church. And we observe one day. The actual conjunction may vary within that day, depending on where we are on the earth. There's another interesting thing about this matter. I once puzzled. Why did the very first calculated new moon, that is the basis of the Hebrew calendar in 3760 B.C., have the sixth day, the eighth hour in the morning, and 0 parts? That is, normally an hour is divided into 1,080 parts. Don't have to worry why it's 1,080, but that's the equivalent of the 44 minutes and 3 1/3 seconds. But this beginning new moon had 0 parts. I thought once, now that's unusual. So I took one of these maps. I don't know of anybody else who's ever done it. At least to my knowledge, nobody has ever written it up. I took a map, you know, where you can see all the time zones, the 24-hour time zones, and I said, suppose we place the 8th hour from midnight, or the 14th hour, from the previous 6 p.m., it depends on how you want to reckon it. I consider it from midnight because that's the simple way astronomically to deal with the problem, since Roman days begin at midnight, you see. I said, suppose this area around Jerusalem were what we would call the 8th hour in the morning. Then around Italy, it would be the 7th hour in the morning. Then somewhere in Britain, you would be in the 6th hour in the morning. And then the thought occurred to me. Now, that's unusual. Because if sunrise, 6 a.m., roughly, you see what I'm talking about in the autumnal equinox, sunrise before we had the daylight saving time and all these things, would be approximately 6 p.m., more or less. Now, if sunrise on this first new moon were actually occurring, that is, the conjunction, let us say, is assigned to a time in a day in which in London or in Britain, because there was no London then, it is sunrise, then you know where sunset would be, essentially where it is today at the international dateline. Because Greenwich, by which we measure a day, is in Britain. And so what the the Hebrew calendar has told us, and apparently the Jews forgot about it, because they didn't know what to do when they went east. They didn't know where the Sabbath should begin, and when they went west, they finally met somewhere. But the Jews have never had a basic tradition of where a day really begins. We have come to recognize that the birthright tribe of Britain, Ephraim, was not incorrect in wisely assigning Britain the 6 a.m. and the middle of the Pacific to 6 p.m. That is, the Hebrew calendar's first conjunction is predicated on the concept of simply a single day and a single hour and no plus. The sixth day, the eighth hour, with no variation, no plus, no second, no minute. And that would indicate that when that conjunction was assigned, the day began on the other side of the globe, in the middle of the Pacific, roughly speaking, around the area of Tonga, New Zealand. And, in fact, it was 6 a.m. in the morning in the British Isles, 7 in the morning, roughly, in Italy, and it would have been 8 in the Hebrew area, that is, the region of Palestine, Syria. This means that the Hebrew calendar also had the concept within it of dividing the earth into a 24-hour, dividing the earth into 24 one-hour time zones. Jesus said, are there not 12 hours in a day? So this is an ancient idea. We can be, therefore, secure in our view of where a day begins. There is nothing to be objected to in the decision that was made in the last century to begin a day in the Pacific, that is, to reconfirm the implications of the Hebrew calendar. Now, there's something unusual about this day. Mr. Salyer mentioned this morning what all of you have heard about and read about before, and the way he put it triggered a thought in my mind in connection to this subject that I've just gone into. So I'll get to our direct subject of the Feast of Trumpets and the implications you should draw. Of that day and hour knows no man, Jesus said in his day, neither the angels, and in one case he said neither the Son, but the Father. He reserves the right of judgment to make the decision of that moment when he will intervene in world affairs. Now this is the Feast of Trumpets that symbolizes the actual warning that is verbal, as well as the actual event later revealed in the book of Revelation that will happen. We've known for a long time that the Feast of Trumpets, symbolized by the blowing of the shofar from the days of Moses when they came out of Egypt, that the Feast of Trumpets, in a sense, represents a time in which the trumpet sounds as an advance warning. Now, it's an advance because God sends his church in advance to make it known what will occur as the crisis at the close begins to develop. God intervenes in world affairs, and Jesus Christ is sent back to reestablish the government of God on earth and bring us peace. Then, actually, there will be the blowing, we presume there will be the sounds of a trumpet that will be heard, 7 of them, according to the book of Revelation, each immediately preceding catastrophes that are listed beginning with Revelation chapter 8, verse 7. The first 4 trumpets are all in Revelation 8. The next 2 are in Revelation 9, and the 7th one is Revelation 11. You will find them in there. We'll come to it a little later. But you see, when Jesus describes this, he said, of that day and hour knows no man. Now, what is unusual about the Feast of Trumpets, I thought, as I was reflecting on this day this morning? You know, once the month is established, you know when the 14th is, because you know when the month begins. That's for Passover. You know when the 15th and the 21st are for the days of unleavened bread. Once you know where the Passover falls in the week, you can determine Pentecost in advance. You don't determine immediately the day of the month, but you can determine exactly which day of the week it will be after which number of Sabbaths. When you come to the Day of Atonement, you know that it will be on the 10th day of the month. Once the month has been established, you know which it is. When it comes to the 15th or the 22nd of this coming Feast of Tabernacles, you will know. There's only one festival that is unusual. Now, today, you may not realize this because we have a fixed calendar that we go by. The Jews essentially fixed this calendar as a result of a decision that had to be made in A.D. 359, when the Romans did not allow any publication of the new moons in the synagogues anymore. So the Jews had to have a calendar determined in advance and not one based on observation, which was characteristic of the Pharisaic rabbinic period after the Pharisees had gained control essentially of the temple and of the calendar, after the Sadducees lost it some short time after the death of Jesus Christ and his resurrection. Now, when you go back to the days of Moses, there's every indication in the days of Moses, in the book of Exodus, that when the community was all in one place, they went by observing the new moon, not determining it specifically by the conjunction of the new moon. The conjunction is that point of absolute invisibility that sometimes you would see as the eclipse of the sun, because you would have the new moon completely dark between the earth and ourselves. The eclipse that occurs in the 15th of the month, such as at the crucifixion, would have been, that is the 14th and 15th at that time period, that would be an eclipse of the moon, but you'd have an eclipse of the sun, only it's a new moon, like a day such as this. Now, what is interesting is that in the Hebrew calendar, you may have either 29 or 30 days. Once the fixed calendar became essential for Jews scattered all over the world, for Christians that are scattered all over the world, there would be no way for us to even telex the message to all the brethren around the world if we had to go by observation of the new moon today. There would be no way. But in the days of Moses, there was no statement that it had to be either by calculation or observation. In fact, the Jews understood that both were formal solutions that could be used depending on the circumstances. When the nation was small and wandering as one body in the wilderness, crossing the Jordan, there would have been no problem. Paul addressed this question because when the Pharisees introduced observations, the new moons became very important. That's why Colossians 2:16 says, "Let no man sit in judgment of you regarding such matters as what the law says about eating and drinking, what God has revealed about holy days, new moons, and Sabbath." New moons became important when Paul was writing to the book of Colossians, and writing to the Colossian church, because at that time the new moons became very important. It was based on observation, not calculation, for that period. And gradually, the Jews were required by circumstances in the Roman Empire to go back to observation, which had been used in earlier times after Moses' day, long after, when the nation spread throughout the Promised Land. And, of course, you had colonies going to different parts. Solomon's ships went here and there. There's every reason to believe that they had a fixed calendar at that time, such as we would have today. But suppose you have the situation. This happens only on the Feast of Trumpets. When is that festival? The answer is, suppose the month before, which is Elul, as we call it, has 29 days, as it now does. We know automatically the next day is the Feast of Trumpets. But as the Jews tell us in the days of the prophets, when some of them were in charge, after they came back to the Holy Land, there are records between, let's say, the return under Zerubbabel and the days of Ezra. There are records when the month of Elul had 29 days and sometimes it had 30 days. Or, to put it in other terms, the Feast of Trumpets, the first day of the seventh month, is, with observation, the only festival that you could not be absolutely sure when it would fall until it began to occur, if you went by observation, which is essentially one of the possible ways in which to determine the calendar. We don't use it today because the Jews have officially said no, and that is sufficient. And there would be no way for us to even inform the brethren if any other form of determination of the calendar were used. We don't have the world equipment today for that, despite all our technology, to communicate with telephone or post, you see, to vast areas of the third world. So we're doing it correctly today. But if it were by observation, when the 29th day of the month occurred, you could not be sure whether the next day was in fact the 30th of Elul or the 1st of Tishrei. It is the only festival where, in a sense, you would have to wait to the end of 29 days of that 6 month and discover either that the new moon is visible or is not visible. Now that is significant because what you heard this morning, what Jesus himself had said so many years ago, is that this time of crisis is coming at a point in which the world as a whole does not know, and even the details, though they are laid out, are not yet so precisely known to the church today as to enable us to determine the exact year-by-year course of events. It is unique, therefore, that the Feast of Trumpets is the only festival that should be so illustrative. The reason is that it occurs on the first day of the new moon, which, in other words, would either have been the month, the day after day 29 or the day after day 30. Depending on whether by observation the new moon was visible the evening after the 29th or only the evening after the 30th. That, I think, is a significant matter. When we reflect on it, what it means is clear, that that festival that we are celebrating today was meant to tell us that however close we would have come to it, we always must be observant and watch events, because it might happen sooner at the close of 29 days or later at the close of 30 days of the 6 months. Now, of course, you all are aware of some implications. We are celebrating today the beginning of the seventh month. In a certain sense, we are saying we're looking back on 6 months of time, each month in that sense being a symbol of the 6,000 years that are to elapse. And the Feast of Trumpets, in a sense, opens up the events that lead immediately to the beginning of the next 1,000 years of human experience. Now, these are broadly speaking analogies, just like the week is an analogy in which the Sabbath represents the seventh 1,000-year period. These autumn festivals, you see, all in one month, we are associating these events as events that will begin to happen at the beginning of a period of time that will, in fact, introduce the millennium. The church has had a general understanding. Now, when I say the church has had, we mean that when we look at the scripture, the evidence, however thorough it has been studied, may be only partial. We should keep our minds open. But the implication from Daniel and Revelation is that there is a period essentially of slightly more than 3.5 years in the crisis at the close. 300. day of the Lord that is somewhere within that 3.5 years. Now, quite commonly, we've spoken casually, written casually, that the tribulation is 3.5 years, but technically the church does not teach it that way. The crisis at the close is some 3.5 years. The tribulation is likely to be more than 2 years. More than 2 years, but we have divine intervention, the heavenly signs, and then we have the beginning of the day of the Lord. And the beginning of the day of the Lord, if a day equals a year, we have tended to see, get my thought, we have tended to perceive that the time in which God intervenes in world affairs,